Hello, and welcome to Safari Conversations, the Singita podcast. Even though we've been around for 30 years, we're relatively new to podcasting. But we are storytellers by nature, and we've got so much to share with you. Alongside our conservation partners, we've been busy exploring and protecting Africa's wilderness. So join us as we unpack inspiring, fun, and sometimes crazy stories where you'll meet our incredible people and learn all about the special places in Africa that we call home. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Safari Conversations. My name is Tash and I am the Assistant Lodge Manager at Singita Pumshana in the Malilangwe Private Game Reserve, Zimbabwe. Today we are talking to Sarah Kigg, who has dedicated her life and career to rhino conservation. She is also based here in the Malilangwe Reserve. We are speaking about another species of concern, the rhinos. I am excited to have this important conversation with Sarah, especially about the two historic rhino relocations into Gonarajol National Park. Sarah, a very warm welcome to you and thank you for taking your time to speak to us today. Please tell us about your work with the black and white rhinos at Malilangwe Reserve in Zimbabwe.
Well, hi Tash. Thank you for inviting me to talk to you today. I'm always excited to talk about rhinos. I'm lucky enough to have the job of studying and monitoring Malilangwe's black and white rhinos.
That sounds like an incredible job to me. Can you explain to our listeners what Malilangwe does and what it is all about?
Malilangwe is a non-profit philanthropic organization that invests in conservation, community upliftment, and in education, all with a focus on local development. And actually, I was one of the 28 fortunate postgraduate students to benefit from a Malilangwe bursary, and that was to study my master's degree in ecology. That was back in 1996. And now, almost 30 years later, I'm still here.
That is incredible to hear and clearly means you definitely love what you do. Can you tell us a bit about the work that you are currently doing now?
So at the moment, my focus is on rhinos and in particular in black rhino social ecology.
And your interests in rhinos, why did you choose to study rhinos?
Well, actually, I didn't choose rhinos. It's just that a couple of things drew me in that direction. When I was at university in South Africa in KwaZulu-Natal, I used to spend my July vacs volunteering to do game counts at Nkuzi Game Reserve. The counts were done on foot, and part of the job was to identify rhinos when we saw them through their ear notches. We would be able to give the ID to the research department then. It would help them with their work. Of course, at the time, I had no idea that my future would be in this kind of work in Zimbabwe.
And what would you say is your favorite part about your job?
Well, there's no doubt for me that my favorite part is field work. I love being out in the bush.
It is quite the experience being out there. What do you spend most of your time doing?
So most of my time is spent studying the rhino records and summarizing what the scouts are collecting and what they're seeing on a daily basis. I try to find patterns of behavior that will help me to understand these two populations of rhino better so that when we need to make management decisions, like translocations, we can carry these out in the most informed way so that we can cause as little discomfort and stress to the rhinos.
Sarah, you said your favorite part about your job is being out doing field work. Do you get to do a lot of field work?
Well, I think I never get to do as much as I'd like to. I do get to go out in the field when we do the rhino notching, which is what we do when young rhinos reach a certain age just before they leave their mothers, and we immobilize them to give them their own unique identity. And this is through little cuts in their ears. And I manage to get out in the field occasionally too to check our rhinos to see for myself what sort of body condition they're in and what their health is like, what they're up to, what they're eating and that sort of thing.
Why are black and white rhino species of conservation importance? What is their role in the ecosystem and why do we need to help save them? Can you also tell us about the difference between the black and white rhinos for our listeners?
Okay, well, first of all, white rhinos, their numbers dropped so low at the end of the 19th century that they were actually thought to be extinct. But they've recovered so well that currently they're actually more numerous than the black rhinos. Today, at the end of last year, I think they estimated that we have about 16,000 or just under 16,000 white rhino left and just under 7,000 black rhino left. But having said that, it's important for us to be aware that in the last 13 years, it's estimated that we've lost about 5,500 white rhino to poaching. So although they've made a big comeback since the beginning of the 20th century, they're in a bad place at the moment because of the trend, because the pattern seems to be on the decline. So now let's look at how we recognize the difference between a black and a white rhino. White rhino have got broad, flat mouths, which is perfectly structured for feeding on grass, like a cow. So if you think about a cow and a white rhino, they both have similarly shaped square lips, and that helps them to harvest grass in the most efficient way. They're also about double the size of a black rhino, and they have a hump called a nuchal hump, which is positioned right where the head joins the neck. Black rhinos don't have this. Black rhinos feed in the same way that goats do. They have a pointed lip, and this is to help them to harvest their preferred type of food, which is browse. And browse is essentially leaves and twigs and flowers, and that kind of thing. And they need to be able to manipulate these to pick the pieces that they want off. The last difference that I'm going to tell you about today is their difference in temperaments. And this is obviously a very important thing to know if you're going to be walking out in the bush, because generally, white rhino are quite docile and you can get up quite close to them without them being concerned. But typically, black rhino are, I'd say, emotionally charged. They're often described as being aggressive because when you catch them off guard, they tend to either charge you or run away in a sort of undignified way. You asked me about their role in the ecosystem. Well, first of all, I just need to point out that every species has a role in the ecosystem. And if you don't think they have, then you just don't know enough about them. And there's so much that we don't know about our environment that it's easy to think that something might not have a purpose. But now if we look at rhinos, they're mega herbivores. And because of their very large body size, they have the potential to engineer significant impacts on the environment. The way that they modify their environment then has cascading effects on other species. So for example, black rhino can browse tough plant stems. And this encourages the new fresh regrowth of soft and nutritious browse that it now becomes available for other smaller species that might not have that available without the black rhino. And also because of the way that they browse, they're able to keep at bay bush encroachment. And this maintains open habitat for grazers like the white rhino. The white rhino, similarly, it grazes areas into what we call grazing lawns. And again, this fresh regrowth becomes available for other smaller species. Another really interesting thing about rhinos is that they are responsible for initiating water holes and pans simply by the way that they scrape or wallow. And often these form at the base of a termite mound. And what's really interesting and what we've discovered in the last few years is that these seasonal pans become the home for tiny aquatic invertebrates like fairy shrimps. And these fairy shrimps actually depend on wallowing animals like rhinos to transport their eggs in the mud on their bodies from one pan to another. And so this is just one of the functions that rhinos perform. And it's a function that may appear obscure to you and me and unimportant, but if you're a fairy shrimp, this is actually vital for your survival. And they also, we've noticed, there are very specific parasites that the rhinos are host to. So once the rhino is lost, these parasites also go extinct. And I was just thinking, can you imagine how many other undiscovered roles these rhinos are performing and what kind of consequences there will be for their extinction on other species that depend on them for their very survival? At the moment, rhino are getting a lot of attention because of their dwindling numbers. And if there is any positive that we can take out of this, it's that if this attention can be channeled into not only saving rhinos, but to save the habitat, it means that we'll be able to protect the whole ecosystem. So not just the charismatic species, big animals, but also everything, right down from smallest insect or bird through plants, reptiles, amphibians, and then finally up to the large mammals. And while it's imperative that we do preserve a safe and healthy environment for citizens other than humans in this planet, humans will benefit enormously from the existence of wild places. So for our own species' mental and emotional health, it's absolutely essential that these natural places are kept functioning and that they continue to exist.
Thank you so much for that detailed answer. So guests at Singita Malilango actually have incredible rhino sightings. Sadly, both the black and white rhino in Africa as well as in Asia are threatened or endangered. Can you talk a bit about what is driving this crisis?
Tash, so first of all, just a bit of background. As you said, there are 5 species of rhino still around today. 3 are from Asia and 2 from Africa, but all of them are sort of in danger of extinction. Initially, their numbers declined due to habitat loss because our human population exploded and obviously we took up a lot of what was their habitat. But in more recent times, the catastrophic declines have been attributed to illegal commercial poaching. And this poaching, as everyone knows, is for their horn. And the horn products are sought over primarily in the East for use in traditional medicine, and nowadays more and more as a status symbol.
And what are some of the challenges you are facing when it comes to protecting the rhinos?
We have the same challenges that are common to all rhino custodians, and that's obviously to keep our rhinos safe from poachers. But protecting rhinos is very costly. It requires significant and sustained funding. We at Malilangwe have been more fortunate than most when it comes to this, because we've received reliable funding over the last 30 years. And we've also been extremely fortunate in that we have loyal staff and low turnover rates here. And I really think that this stability, together with a level of contentment in our staff, goes a long way to curtailing poaching. Because what people have discovered is that most poaching actually involves internal corruption. So if you can keep your staff happy and they buy into your purpose, you can largely control poaching. And so far, we've managed to keep our rhinos safe. But that success has also brought along challenges, because obviously an expanding population isn't accompanied by an expanding fence line. And ultimately, a time comes when we need to translocate rhinos to new places to begin new populations. And obviously, this is something to celebrate. And it means now that we can restore rhinos to habitats where they've been lost. But I must point out that it's very traumatic for both the rhino populations to be disrupted. And it's very sad for those of us who have protected and got to know these rhinos as individuals over the years. So to see them go, I have to admit it is a sad thing, although a necessary thing. Translocations mean we've got to obviously move rhinos off this property. And if you want to do them sensitively, you really need to know about the population that you have, because of these criteria that you need to meet if you want a successful translocation, if you want the new population to basically work out and you don't want to disrupt your home population. Because what we have found is that if we don't take care of these kind of issues, we end up having fighting back at home. So it means that the social bonds that existed are disrupted to the point that animals have to regroup themselves, and the whole hierarchy and dominance needs to play out, and we tend to have fighting and associated deaths because of that. So to minimize those kind of negative repercussions of translocation, you've got to spend a lot of time working out which groups to separate and how to separate it. Also, where there's alloparenting, where the community looks after each other, when you rip those bonds apart, new populations might not have the support that they need for the offspring to integrate from being dependent on their mother to going off into the community as independent animals. There's usually a transition period where they are kind of taught and protected by older animals, sometimes adult females, sometimes animals their own age. They form groups, particularly the white rhinos. And if you aren't careful about the group that you send and the group that you're leaving behind, and make sure that those bonds are still intact to some degree, you can really cause some disruptions. The actual process that is involved when you do a translocation, well, the way that we do it at Malilangwe, is that we would have pre-selected the animals that we decided will make a good group to start a new population or to augment an existing one. And our scouts are given this list, and based on the ear notches, they'll then go and search for them. Once they've found someone on that list, they radio us in, and we'll go out with a helicopter. We've got the drug loaded for the right dose for the animal that we know we're going to dart. And in the meantime, the trucks would get down to the area where the animal had been found, And then we'd get up in the helicopter, come in and dart it. And sometimes you need to herd it towards where the trucks are because it's not long, only about 4 minutes from the time you dart an animal to the time it actually goes to sleep. So as close as possible to the trucks. When we get down, we've actually got a drug that for the white rhino, we can keep the animal sort of sedated, but we're able to walk it into the truck, which is the best way of doing things. It's kind of the least invasive. And it goes into a metal crate that's custom made for the rhino. And using crane trucks, we lift that crate onto the truck and the crate is secured to the truck very carefully and very thoroughly. And it's transported across to its destination, in this case, Conerijo, with at least two guys who know how to deal with drugs and know how to read an animal's behavior and health in the way that it reacts to the drugs during the translocation. So it's carefully monitored. The guys on the back have contact with the truck drivers and with the vets. And, you know, if necessary, we'll stop along the way. You know, the trip's just very carefully monitored from start to end. When we get to the destination, everything's quiet before the animal's reversed, and then it's literally reversed out of the crates. And yeah, just takes some time to settle. There are a couple of ways that people do translocations. Some are hot translocations where they basically release them straight into the new sanctuary without a boma. We don't do that. We feel that we would like to watch the animal for at least a couple of days to make sure that the drug is out of the system and that it's completely compos mentis before it goes out into the wild, because if they've still got the effects of the drug, they can easily make mistakes like moving too far away from water, not drinking. And because these animals are so precious, we really don't want to take any chances that are unnecessary. So we always boma, and we make sure that they've recovered before they go out into the greater part of the park. And in this case, because we were moving groups of known animals, we wanted them to reform their bonds before they went out. We didn't want them to go out as single animals, because as single animals, they are less kind of emotionally stable, and the great magnetism to come back home to Malalangwe is not controlled at all by having a companion with them. We had one animal which was selected because it was in a group of three, and it had a very early calf after it got to Conerijo. And its friend then felt a bit lonely and tried to come back. The third member of the trio actually came back to the Malalangwe Boundary Friends, basically collected it and took it back to the sort of central part of the new sanctuary. So that was also beautiful to see.
I can imagine. Sarah, we are situated right next to the well-known National Park Conerijo. Can you share what the situation there has been? Is it true that rhinos have been extinct twice there?
Yes, sadly, that is true. Like most parts of Southern Africa, or most parts of Africa, Conerijo lost its population of rhinos by the 1940s. But between 1969 and 1977, they brought back, I think, 77 rhinos from the Zambezi Valley. But very sadly, by 1994, poaching had done its thing and there were none left. So both times, poaching was responsible for the loss of those rhinos.
And aren't you worried that this will happen again?
You know, Tash, this is always a worry when you translocate animals to a new place. You always worry for their safety. But Conerijo has had really good, consistent support from Frankfurt Zoological Society since 2007. And with this additional funding and with a great team of national park staff and Frankfurt Zoological staff who work very well together as a cohesive team, I do believe that the park now has what it takes to successfully protect rhinos. And this is why we felt confident enough to send a group of black rhino there in 2021, and why we've sent a group of white rhino earlier this year. And what I think is really wonderful about Conerijo as a destination for our rhino, apart from the fact that it's right next door and we can visit them, is that there is the space there and the potential for the growth of healthy populations of both black and white rhino that I think can make a material contribution to global rhino conservation.
That is a good news. And I know you did mention that obviously that this is a costly project. Can you tell us about the Malalangwe Trust's rhino project and how Singita Guest can support them?
Tash, we have a couple of specific projects on the go. But we also have, of course, the routine ongoing work that is done by our anti-poaching and our research teams. I'll touch on a couple of the projects that we have on the go at the moment. And the first big one deals with rhino genetics, and it's aimed at providing insights into how black rhinos select their mates, how many mates they have, and the duration of these pair bonds. And I think it's very important that we understand these kind of social interactions, because when it comes to selecting individuals for moves, we need to make sure that we avoid as much as possible disrupting the social stability, both in our home population and in the group that we're going to move. So I think that's really important. And then also on the genetic side, it's valuable for us to understand the genetic implications of any management decisions that we make, again, moving animals around, because we're dealing with an endangered and a threatened species, and we can't afford to make mistakes with these precious remnant populations. And the second project that we're actually involved in at the moment is an overhaul of our wildlife records database, which was originally built in the year 2000, so it's quite old now. It's a Microsoft Access SQL Server database, and it stores all our wildlife records, including detailed information about our rhinos. I just checked, and currently there are just under 500,000 records in that database. And last year, very kindly, we received funding from Raw Africa's Women Empowerment Group, which allowed us to begin work on the overhaul of this database. But we found that the project has proved so big that we're actually going to need to continue it into 2026. Then, I don't know if you can call this a project because it's ongoing and it's year after year, is the ear notching. Every year we need to notch between 50 and 60 rhino calves, and this requires hiring in a helicopter and an experienced wildlife veterinarian, and of course, all that goes along with that, including rather specialized drugs. And then lastly, but definitely not least, the routine work that we do, and of course, this is also very expensive. It's absolutely essential, and this involves the protecting and auditing of our rhinos. And it's done by a team of 90 anti-poaching scouts and 3 research technicians. So each day when the scouts are out on patrol, they will collect data on the animals that they see, including the rhinos, and these are detailed right down to the individuals that they see. And then these details are then collected into their field books and logged into a database. And then we scrutinize these records to gain insights to our population's dynamics and behaviors. And these are the insights that we use to make informed decisions when we have to intervene with our populations.
Just in terms of the rhino notching, obviously we've also had guests who've had the opportunity of being on the field when that is happening. And always it's just amazing to hear what the experience is like for someone who's never gotten that close to the animals and being on the ground and being able to assist an animal, which is just incredible work. And we have one guest in particular. She's a multiple repeat and comes back each year. And I think she did hers, if it's not last year, it's the year before. And she always talks about it every time she comes back, of what a memorable experience it was and just the appreciation of the work that goes into those projects. As well as at Singita Bomshana, we've got the beautiful conservation room, which is also an amazing space that we share the information with our guests of the incredible work that is being done at Malilangwe. And it consists of the community projects as well as the conservation projects. And our guides are the ones that take the guests in there and talk about the work. And it's definitely a great interactive activity for both guests and children, which is a space that is loved by all the guests that do come and visit the property. Sarah, what do you think the role of ecotourism is in preserving habitat for rhinos in Africa?
Well, I think these days ecotourism is vital for conservation and for the long-term persistence of wild landscapes and for habitat for rhinos. And I say this not only because ecotourism brings in essential funding, but more importantly because being immersed in nature tends to stoke a deep and genuine appreciation for the natural world. And I think this can remold the way that we think. I mean, you mentioned your guest who's a repeat and who keeps talking about her experience at rhino notching. I think that's just one example. Being in the environment, immersed right here, is so much more powerful than seeing it on TV or hearing about it. So we do want to expose as many people as possible to this kind of experience. And I think it's becoming even more important nowadays because our modern technologically driven lives draw us away from interacting with the natural world. There are fewer and fewer people that are working with the land, to the point that it's easy for us to forget our dependence and our part in nature. And I think that this disconnection or this ignorance, it can actually be extremely dangerous because it predisposes us to making catastrophic decisions for all life on Earth, including our own, because we just forget how much we depend on nature. And I think that visiting a wilderness resets us, and it reminds us that we live in an impressive world, which we're only a small part, but we're an extremely powerful part with a huge responsibility. And I really do hope that the guests that visit Pamashana are stirred and humbled by what they experience here. And I really hope that that experience will instill a deep respect and appreciation for the value of our natural world, so much so that the realization will filter every decision that they make in the future. And ultimately, this is what we need if we want these profound experiences to be available for our children and for generations to come. And having said that, I also need to point out that tourism can actually destroy wilderness. And that's if it's practiced irresponsibly without humility and respect. And I think it's very important that we put the interests of the wilderness before our entertainment, and we make sure that we practice tourism for conservation rather than the other way around. We need to be careful that we guard that our greed to be entertained doesn't compromise the very entity that we've come to celebrate in places like Nalalangwe. And I think there are some places where, you know, that line has been overstepped. Being aware of this line can actually help make sure that we don't compromise the wilderness.
Sarah, yes, we do need to, obviously, the humility and respect for this wonderful place that we get to experience on a daily basis and the people that get to visit us as well. There is such a great need in Africa and resources are quite limited. What do you measure as success and where is hope for the future?
First of all, you are correct. There is an increasing demand for resources, particularly for land. As Africa's human population continues to grow exponentially, there will be increasing pressure to take wildlife sanctuaries away from nature to give them over to human development. And that is why it's critically important that we expose the new generation and the old to the value of wild places. Because these are the people who hold the future of wildlife and wildlands in their hands. And we need them to be as enlightened as possible so that they can make wise decisions that in most cases will be permanent. To your second point about how I define success, I think that each time we are able to give a person an opportunity to experience the wilderness and to feel how moved they are by it, I think I would qualify that as success because we've given them a chance to be won over, to be appreciators of nature and the natural world. And I believe this because it's very difficult to persuade someone to love and protect our planet if they haven't experienced its magic. And this is one of the reasons we bring around 500 rural school children from our neighboring communities through our camps each year. And it's one of the reasons why we practice tourism here. It's because we want to expose as many people as possible to the magic of the wild world and how important it is to care for it and to keep it going. One of the most wonderful successes that I can say I've been a part of is the success that our population of rhinos has grown to the point that we've been able to take rhinos and put them back into places that have lost them. For somebody working with rhinos, like for me, this is probably one of the most rewarding things in your career, is to have seen your population grow to that point where you can now start distributing them back into the environment or into the landscapes from which they've been lost. And as for my hope for the future, I really hope that we will be able to continue to protect and share the magic of a rich and healthy ecosystem, to see it carrying out its processes as it was designed to, and that through this we'll recruit an army of ambassadors for conservation so that the future of wild landscapes and wild creatures is secure for the next generation. I'd say that would be my greatest hope.
That is incredible. Thank you, Sarah. And I know, obviously, with your work that you do, you must have many, many amazing stories. But can you tell us one of your favorite rhino stories?
Well, Tash, since we've been discussing the recent moves to Gonarejo, I'll tell you a story that touched me quite deeply recently, actually in May, when we moved those rhinos. At this point, I think it's relevant for me to give you some background on how we selected the group of white rhinos for the May translocation to Gonarejo. The process actually took me more than a couple of months to come up with the group. So first of all, I scrutinized every recorded sighting and social interaction between the rhinos in a particular part of the property that I thought could benefit from destocking. So I looked at 4 months before the move needed to take place, and I checked out what they were doing. And my plan was to uplift an entire social group of rhinos because I wanted to cause as little social disruption as possible. But the social group that I needed to choose had to meet quite rigorous criteria. It had to incorporate individuals from as many family lines as possible so that we could maximize genetic diversity in the new population. But it also, the individuals had to be friends, as I say. They couldn't be strangers to one another. The group had to have an equal number of males and females, and they couldn't be animals that were too young or too old. So you can imagine it was quite difficult to come up with that group. But finally, I got my 30 animals selected. And then, as always happens during an operation, midway through, there's something that happens. An animal has a calf. We find that the calves we hadn't sexed are all males. We have to adjust the group so that we can provide or stick with those rules that we tried to put in place in the beginning. So anyway, we had one of those. We adjusted, and we started the op. And every day we took probably between 2 and 3 rhinos up to the new Boma, and it took 2 weeks for us to take the whole group across. Now, first of all, for those of you who don't know what a Boma is, it's basically just a Southern African name for a paddock or a fenced-in area. And the Boma we put them in was quite big. And the reason we held them in this enclosure was because we wanted to make sure that the whole group had found each other and settled and recovered from the translocation before we let them out into the wider sanctuary. Now, it's interesting because the rhino that we had already moved to the Boma began to learn that when they heard the sound of the truck coming, it usually meant that more friends were being brought to them. And so we found that each time we brought a new rhino in, the rhino that were already there migrated towards us and towards the truck to see who was going to be delivered. And it was very touching. After new arrivals were released and they came out of their crates, you'd see this happy greeting and body touching, and you could literally see that these rhino were happy to see each other and to find each other. As things turn out, there was the last rhino, which was just being absolutely difficult to find. But when we finally brought him to the Boma, it was nighttime because it had taken us so long to find him. And this particular night, it was full moon, which was just wonderful because it added to the experience. The truck arrived, and as usual, got into place, put the crate into the Boma. And at this point, everything goes silent as the vet prepares to give the reversal stroke. And everybody's silent. So as we sat there and we looked into what was happening, most of us sitting on top of crates, on top of trucks, we saw these huge, well, about a score of huge shadows like ships on a calm, dark sea, moving slowly towards the truck and to us. And as they moved through these low bushes, we could hear them communicating between themselves with whale-like whines and whistles and a few snorts. And then finally, when the last guy backed out of his crate, he was greeted by this huge welcoming committee. And after they received him, they all just melted back into the shadows. And I have to say that that was one of the most moving experiences of my life. And I feel enormous appreciation for having had the chance to experience an event like that and to have been allowed to see that we, in this case, we had selected the right group of animals for the establishment of the new population. It really was a rare and emotionally rewarding experience for me, and I will never forget it.
What a heartwarming experience. And thank you so much for sharing that with us. I wish we had more time to just keep going on and on. But thank you so much for making the time to speak to us and sharing the amazing work that you all do at Malangwe in protecting these wonderful species.
Thanks, Tash, for letting me share my experiences.
And thank you also to our listeners. And for more information, please visit the Singita website. We'll also link the Malulangwe Trust website in the show notes. Until next time.
Thank you for listening. If you want to follow other episodes of our podcast series, Safari Conversations, please follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from or on our website at singita.com.